Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. This is the Awaken Call with Trupti Pandya. We're going to get started in just a minute. My name is Rish, and I'm really excited to be your host for our weekly Global Awaken Call. Welcome to all, and thank you for joining us. Every story is the beginning of a conversation, whether it is with ourselves or with others. Across time and cultures, stories have been agents of personal transformation, in part because they have the power to change our hearts and minds. The purpose of our weekly call to share stories from incredible change makers from around the globe. Through thoughtfully guided conversations with them, our special guest speakers share their personal stories and inspire us through their actions, their experiences, and their insights. Our hope is that these conversations will plant seeds for a more compassionate and service-oriented society while serving to foster our own inner transformation. Behind each of these calls is an entire team of service-based volunteers whose invisible work allows us to hold this beautiful space. We are thankful to them and to all of our listeners for helping co-create this space. Today, we are grateful to have a remarkable guest speaker with us, Trupti Pandya, whose personal journey is inspiring and has had a tremendous impact on many people. I've had the pleasure of meeting her myself, but I will save the introductions for our moderator, Sachi. But Trupti, I do want to say thank you for joining today's call. Let us start with a minute of silence to anchor ourselves into the space. Welcome again to our weekly Awaken Call, today in conversation with Trupti Pandya. Here's how the call works. In a few minutes, our moderator, Sachi Maniar, will engage in a deep dialogue with our speaker, Trupti Pandya, and by the top of the hour, we'll roll into Q&A and Circle of Sharing, where we invite all your reflections and questions. I've opened up the queue right now, so at any point, you can hit *6 on your phone, and you'll be prompted when it's your turn to speak. You can also email us in real time at ask@servicespace.org. This week's theme, as I shared earlier, is adding compassion to the prescription therapy list. Our guest this week has found a skillful middle way between her structured studies and training in Western psychology and her heart's commitment to deeper healing through love. The question for all of us to reflect on, how have you navigated your head and heart to stretch and reach more deeply in your profession or work? To engage in this dialogue with Trupti, we have the great pleasure of having Sachi as our moderator today. For those of you that don't know Sachi, she works with juveniles who have been in and out of the justice system in Mumbai. And we recently had the pleasure of having her over in the Bay Area, where she bowled everyone over with her energy, passion, and her extreme commitment to social justice issues. Sachi, thank you for joining us. Please feel free to share some of your reflections before you introduce our speaker, Trupti, and open up the conversation with her.
Thank you, Rish. It's really a pleasure to be doing this, and thank you for the generous introduction. I actually will straight up start with Trupti's introduction because I really want her to share more about her journey. So to begin with, I've known Trupti for about 4 to 5 years, and I've had the opportunity to see her in action. I am thinking of this one time when Trupti was taking a session in the Dongri Children's Home where I work, which is this, you know, really like very concrete, very traumatic place where all these girls are kept, and you know, who these are girls who've gone through extreme trauma or are addicted and hyper, they indulge in self-harm. And so you know, I was walking by the home, you know, where the girls are kept, and I saw Trupti taking a session, and you know, really she was actually taking them through meditation and through, you know, reflection and so many other, you know, small things that by the end of it, the girls actually came up to me and said, you know, they were feeling very calm and happy. And it, for to me, to watch the session, which was around 1.5 hours, it felt like she literally picked the girls up who were drowning and gave them a new life. And so this is what she can do in an hour or hour and a half. Yeah, so she is she's a great inspiration to me and someone I really look up to and, you know, fall back on when I'm doing my own work. She's worked with people in with people and in places where most people would think twice before entering. And beyond her regular work list of working in prisons or with, you know, people who are schizophrenic and things like that, she has, you know, done projects and initiatives that are, you know, endless. Whether it's like anchoring awakened calls or heart circles or starting a community or even bringing these alternative therapies into the universities in Baroda. She's been at it with what I love about her is she does everything with so much focus and giving her more than 100% and really focusing on the small practices rather than like the big questions. The other thing that for me is, you know, for me what stands out about Tukti is that she's always reflecting and working on her own self through various personal practices and experiments. We'll hear about all of those now soon, but I know Tukti doesn't like to be center stage and she doesn't like to be in focus. So I'm very, very grateful to her for saying yes to sharing her journey today. I really want to thank you, Tukti, for this. Tukti, are you ready for the list of questions?
Yes, Sachi. Thank you.
How are you feeling?
I'm feeling awesome, and especially after such a warm welcome, I'm feeling so grateful to the whole SSP team and to both of you and to all the ones who have joined the call. Thank you.
Thank you. So to begin with, I thought we can start, you know, maybe with your journey. And, you know, we'll trace back a little bit in your journey as to how you started, you know, engaging in psychology. Were you always interested in psychology or working with children or women in difficult situations? What got you here?
Thank you for asking that, Sachi. It's quite an unbelievable story. But my inspiration to take up psychology came from a Bollywood movie where the actor was actually suffering from split personality and how the psychologist solved the whole mystery. I was quite fascinated with her role, and that actually led me to psychology. Till then, I had no clue about the subject. And I think when I was in grade 11 or 12, I remember we had our educational visit to the Hospital for Mental Health. I had always seen the high walls from outside with the fencing and lot of security. And as friends, we would often joke that, you know, with your behavior, I think you should be admitted to this hospital, which we called as the mental hospital. But when I actually went inside, I saw a few people behind the bars, a few who seemed lost in their own world, which was as real as mine. And reality struck very hard that these high walls, which were separating us and them, they are people like us, and they were suffering in a different way. But why were they put into such a hard environment was something that disturbed me a lot. And I think this is how I got introduced to psychology. And of course, work-wise, I had no plans of working with a certain kind of population, maybe children or women. In fact, I always told my friends that I'll never work with children, but nature had its own plans. And since college, I landed up in organizations that only had children. And now I love working with them. And I feel super awesome to have the bunch of experiences that I had while I was spending time with them. So, yeah.
Wow. That's awesome. And so, like, what was your learning or observations, but, you know, when you were working with kids, what came up for you?
one very significant observation, or I should say a red thread that I saw emerging was the history of children. So there were multiple factors that play a role in the way the child behaves, right? And I noticed that the intensity of deviant behavior was much more higher in two cases. One was when there was a lot of conflict at home within the family. And secondly, when there was lack of acceptance of the child, especially when in the cases of special needs children. And I observed this trend in my current workplaces also, where children or adults who end up in prisons or in observation homes, mostly when I talk to them, I see a history of broken family or of difficult childhood. And somewhere I felt that a child's being had a direct reflection of the experiences and relationships that he shared with his immediate family. And so, like more than working with the child, I felt that something had to be done or something had to be changed inside the family. And before that, it even gave me a clue, like a faint clue, that before any therapy worked, it was actually love and acceptance which would mitigate the intensity of the conflict for the child and for the family both. But the question was how, and what does it like really look to have a space that nurtures everyone in a wholesome way? And I remember this phase of mine. I was going mad, feeling suffocated with the labeling procedure. The hospital where I was working, I always had this constant pressure of, you know, finding out the diagnosis because they wanted to loop in the patient into the medicinal procedure. And I always felt that, you know, I think I should spend more time with the child or with the family, which I wasn't allowed to in a way. And I did not feel that what I was doing was right. And each day I would come back home feeling guilty, and I knew that something was not right and something was missing. And finally, I decided to step back from all my professional areas till the time I found that missing link, or, you know, maybe I find my own peace. So I left all my work for like some time.
Yeah. Wow. So, you know, actually, what you shared is so amazing, because I often feel, even when I see psychologists in the children's home, they feel so stuck, and they want to limit themselves by what is prescribed or what is the correct psychologist code. They're so restricted in their being that it's so impossible for them to actually build a rapport with the children or with their, you know, as they call their clients. I'm amazed that you actually, you know, realized that. And then what did you do? Like, you felt stuck and you said you quit everything and you didn't do anything. So then what was that journey like, and how long was it? What were the questions you were asking? What were the answers you got? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, Sachi. So, of course, there was no plan. I just stopped working and I didn't know really what to do. But things came in. I think it was a year's time, and there were like so many different experiences back to back. And today when I look back, I know for sure that each experience was like a milestone, and it was preparing for me for the work that I'm doing today. And while I was still contemplating on the missing link, I felt that an individual is the byproduct of the family, and this big world is the byproduct of multiple families, right? So the intersection point was the family. So something, as I said, the shift had to happen in the family. And I started thinking of my own family, and the question that I was holding was that, what is that unsaid or unseen fuel which keeps the family, like the system functioning? And a very clear answer that came, of course, like after contemplating a lot, a very clear thing that came up for me was my values and the value system that a family holds. I think that was the core of the family, or something which one can refer to or hold on to during crisis situations. And I realized that it was time to move the lens inward before I start working with others. As I myself needed like time to find my own values or maybe align them in the right way. And it said that when you have the right questions, the teachers, they arrive, right? So I haven't met Gandhi or Vinoba. I have only read about them in books. But here I started meeting a bunch of them who are actually living those values that was like so powerful. I had always heard words like, you know, truth or being kind or being compassionate, but I never knew how. It was only something that I'd heard. And when I closely observed people like Arun Dada, Miraba, Kanti Dada, I saw those values alive. And actually, I feel that their way of life is their message, which is reflected in a very simple way into their day-to-day living, and which is like so effortless. And this effortlessness or the lightness that they have shows their years of cultivation. And I think meeting them helped me re-engineer my own inner being in a great way. And since then, small practices started happening where the intention, the intention is to weave in those values in my daily life. So that was one thing which happened. In the same year, I started exploring the Move by Love and service-based ecosystem, which led me to my first Vipassana, my first head, hand, heart retreat, Awaken Circle. And meanwhile, in the same year, two very profound experiences that I had was my 6-day walking pilgrimage and my 2-month travel to the Himalayas. I had some invaluable experiences. But knowingly or unknowingly, all these life events that I had during that year, I think it unfolded like lot of my inner being, which I feel was important before dealing with other people's minds. So that was like my 1-year journey.
That's awesome. Like one is it takes a lot of courage to go into something which you don't know and, you know, say that, okay, I'm going to really practice these values. I'm really going to look for these answers or, you know, ask more questions to your own self. And I also know that you not only ask those questions or met people or teachers that, as you say, but you also practice things like, you know, the 6-day walking pilgrimage that I have heard so much about was an incredible journey. So for people on the call, one of our elderly grandfather, Gopal Dada, was a Gandhian and walked with Vinoba Bhave, and he had passed away. And so some of the friends, they decided to take a 6-day walking pilgrimage without money, phone or food in his honor and in the and to honor the spirit that the whole world is our family. So and Tripti decided to join that pilgrimage, and I want to ask you, Tripti, what inspired that? Like why did you join that?
This walk happened in the same month when the news of a very cruel and painful rape incident that happened in Delhi. That news was all over the country. And I remember crying for days together. There was so much of fear that I avoided stepping out of the house for a few days. And this was just one story, right? But the world where I'm currently living, or all of us are living, we are surrounded with a very strong narrative that says that the world outside isn't safe. I cannot, or maybe I should not, trust a stranger who knocks at my door. And just like few days after this incident happened, and after a few days, I got to know about this pilgrimage. And the purpose of this pilgrimage was a complete antidote to my extreme fear, where the intention was to trust the world. The way I trust my own family, believing that this whole world is one family, right? So it was quite crazy, and I took time to like there were, of course, there were like questions that, you know, how do I trust or what will happen, especially when I was going without food. And the night before, I could not sleep. I had all kinds of questions like, will I starve or, you know, will I die? Will I get a safe place to stay? And most importantly, especially in the times when, you know, I use my two-wheeler and I don't walk so much, walking 110 kilometers, it wasn't easy. So I remember my first encounter with hunger that happened on the first day. And I was feeling hungry and I saw two fruit vendors. One vendor had like a lot of different kinds of fruits with him and the other one only had bananas. So my mind told me that, you know, beggars don't have a choice because I had nothing to give him. So I went to the ones who had bananas, and it was so difficult to ask, especially when I had, like, of course, not money, but I had nothing to give in return for the first time, I think, in my life. I still, you know, when I go for a walk, I at least carry like some money. Just to make sure that, you know, if I need something, I have at least some money. And I saw emotions like shame, ego, anxiety, awkwardness tearing up. I went to him, he looked at me, and I started sharing about the experiment that we were doing. And trust me, I couldn't utter more than few words. And then my co-pilgrim joined the conversation and, you know, asked for four bananas, which he did give. And slowly, that was like my first encounter. And slowly I observed my ego melting into humility with all the things that I was receiving. And like, that was the only time we had to actually ask for something. And after that, we were offered food even before we were hungry, actually. And that too with so much love. In fact, few people before leaving their premise, they even offered us money for the next meal when they knew that we were walking without money. So it's only because of the generosity that I experienced from people, especially whom I didn't know, or they were like complete strangers for me. My ideas of trust and scarcity shifted because of them, and which helped me to open my house and share what I say is mine. So yeah, that was one experience that I had during my walk.
That's awesome. I know when you say you open your house, the Pandya sisters really open their house, not only to awaken, but to so many, like from street children to women. I know that the amount of activities that go on just in your house. Yeah. And I also want to ask you to share about the incident. You know, I know you have had a long relationship with fear. And I especially that incident when you had your asthma attack on the pilgrimage. So if you could share a little bit about that and, you know, how you overcame that fear.
Sure. I had asthma since childhood, and partly I had accepted it as a lifetime gift because when I used to go to the doctor, he used to tell me that, oh, your father suffers from it and, you know, you have got it in heredity. So this is going to be there. So I was like, okay. During the asthma attack, it used to make me feel very weak and very vulnerable. Like the whole night, I couldn't sleep. You know, there was like breathlessness, and I was like, it was difficult to see when I was suffering with that. And so part of me had a strong wish to find a cure for it. And while I was doing my post-graduation in clinical and applied hypnosis, we studied that all that is diagnosed, like on the physical body, it is the manifestation of the mental thoughts. This made more sense when my mom was diagnosed with cancer. Till that time, I thought that, okay, cancer happens to only those people who consume tobacco. But my mother never did that. So, you know, why is she suffering from cancer? And that time I came across many, many books and interviews where they shared the similar theory that, you know, our thoughts are basically manifesting on our bodies. And this made even more sense when two of my teachers, they shared about how they could cure their asthma to quite an extent with few techniques that I was learning. And so under their guidance, I started working on myself. And in the next 2 years, I did not get asthma. And of course, it was like a big achievement for me. And I was on the top of the world dancing. And I thought that I've cured it from the root. And out of nowhere, on the third day of our walk, I got a severe asthma attack. And I was not at all prepared for it. I was shocked. And out of that shock, I just kept crying. We had just ended our day. And looking at the history, I knew that I would need at least 3 to 4 days of rest. And this meant that I'll have to leave the pilgrimage and maybe either I'll go home or, you know, all those questions were just coming up. And my confidence started shattering. And later, I was sitting, it was dark and silent, and I could hear my heavy breathing. I was gasping for it, and I could not lie, so I just kept sitting. And I started observing my breath, and for the first time, I looked at it, like the suffering, eye to eye, and I felt some layer shedding away. And bit by bit, I don't know like how many hours I sat that night, and a very strong emotion that I saw coming up was fear. And I realized all that I had learned and, you know, all the experiences that I had heard from my teachers, it was life in front of me. And I knew that I wasn't actually suffering from asthma, but I was actually suffering from the disease of fear. And fear of many kinds. And as that started becoming clearer and clearer, I observed that my breathing started to ease. And it's quite an impossible thing, but the next day we walked almost for 26 kilometers. It's like looking at the past, it's almost impossible. Like I remember I couldn't even carry the blanket that it was December, and I couldn't even carry the blanket that I was, holding. And all my bag, all my stuff, everything was taken away. And we could walk 26 kilometers. And after that, I don't think so. I've again got asthma attacks. So, yeah, that's the story.
Wow. This is actually what inspires me most about you, which is, you know, you go to the heart of things which most people would be even scared to look at. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, I was wondering, like, you know, all of this what you've shared so far is all about your personal journey, your deep, like journey inside, which and everything's been more about getting over your fear. So what led you to discover the other way of working with children and women beyond the structural forms of traditional psychology?
Right. So I didn't know that, you know, this year-long experiment is coming to an end till I met Rish and Seema. Rish, who is with us today. So, again, I have a very interesting story to share where, and as I said that I was suffering from this fear syndrome, I would just say no to anything new that would come in front of me. And doing anything out of my comfort zone was like a big task. And at the same time, after this pilgrimage and after my trip to Himalaya, I was in Pune, and Rish and Seema Didi, they were conducting a workshop where they introduced a very super rocking exercise of saying yes and to anything that life has to offer. And it sounds so simple, right? But it wasn't that easy for me. It was like almost rewiring my old habit. The very same day, I got an email from a very dear friend for a workshop that was happening in Bombay. And I thought that, you know, oh, should I go, should I not? And then I was like, okay, you know, just a day before, I've learned something, and I think I should just try and say yes to it. And thank you, Rish, for that. And every time I say yes to anything new, I remember both of you. So, and that actually got me introduced to art-based therapy. That workshop was on art-based therapy, and it was a five-day workshop. And one of the days, I met the founder of this organization called Kula Asman. They were using art-based therapy for healing. And they were working with the government institutions with children and with women at risk. And I attended the workshop, and then I met the founder of the organization. And it's so amazing. I had no interview, nothing. And she just said that, oh, you know, come and join. And then again, this thing of moving out of my comfort zone, because I had to leave my home, my city. But I said yes to that also. And a whole new thing opened up for me. And that was the time I felt that, okay, finally, after a year-long journey, I have got what I was actually looking for. And art-based therapy was something I think that I was looking forward for.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and we had the privilege of having you in Mumbai for almost a year, thanks to Kula Asman. So tell us a little bit about art-based therapy and, you know, what about it resonated with you and, you know, help you feel unstuck in some ways.
The places where I worked, I would start with that. So technically speaking, the purpose of these homes is to like provide safety and shelter to the population who are at risk. And once they enter these homes, they are not directly exposed to the physical threat, but the trauma that they have gone through, I don't think so, that is taken care. And because that part of them is not healed, they keep revisiting the mental and emotional trauma, which deteriorates their well-being even more. And in places like Bombay, at a time, the number is like mostly in triple digits. So it's huge. So just to give like a little, I would share a story where I was working with this six girls from Bangladesh, and they were rescued from trafficking. They were brought to one of the rescue homes in Bombay, and their age was below 18, and because they were from Bangladesh, they did not know the local language, and they were away from their homes for more than a year now. They were shy, sad, underconfident, fearful, saw no hope ahead, and few of them even had like suicidal tendencies, and due to high stress, their sleep was disturbed, they didn't have a good appetite, and you know, all these emotions were going on at a time, which would come out in the form of like fights or behaviors that were harmful for them and for others who were staying with them. And these were just the visible symptoms, but if we go one step deeper, I would say that, you know, their bodies were abused too. And for the first time, I realized that the memory wasn't only limited to the mind, but it was stored in their bodies also. And this I came to know when for a year we were working with them, and there were like two facilitators who were helping them heal through dance movement. And so dance movement was used as a main tool for healing. And literally their inner walls found a canvas for expression through movement. And catharsis started happening through colors, through the metaphors that they were that they were playing the metaphors that they shared by telling stories, or while molding their memories with a lump of clay. And the most beautiful thing about ABT is that it starts from where the person is, and it happens in a very safe and a non-threatening environment. And the women and children I work with, they every time they don't have like those words to express themselves, but here the medium and process is such that the experience itself becomes so powerful. And there is no right or wrong, no fail or pass criteria, right? Anything that they express is just the expression of their inner self. And the aim of art is like literally to represent out, not the outward appearance of things, but their inward significance. And to cut the long story short, these six girls healed themselves, of course, with the help of the facilitators. And later they asked us to train them as trainers so that they could do similar work till the time they were staying in that home where there were like another, 70 girls. And they said that in our country, in Bangladesh, there is a lot of trafficking that happens. And so once when we get back, we want to do similar work and stop this. So this was my first-hand experience, where I realized the power of art-based therapy, and where it was, I think it was more like connecting to the child with inside us, and doing like simple things, like using simple tools, like coloring or clay or movement or storytelling. So these are the mediums through which the healing was happening. And the most amazing part which I feel about ABT is that it doesn't make a person dependent on the therapist or any kind of drug, but it makes a person self-reliant gradually in a very simple way. So I feel that's the power of ABT, and that is what I aligned to the most.
That's awesome. That's a great story. Thank you for sharing. But I also know that your work is not limited to art-based therapy only, or psychology per se, because it's also a lot to do with what you do is related to who you are, your presence, and the circles you conduct, and the small things that you do, and your commitment of being there in service to these women and children. So I mean, I know that currently you're working in a government-run home where there are women with severe mental illnesses like schizophrenia, severe depression or retardation. I know there are women with HIV or physical deformities and burns. And in the same complex, there are adolescent girls and children who are abandoned. So, and although your role over there is limited to counseling or psychology, when you go there, you don't stop yourself from doing other things. Like, I know a great story that Swara had shared with me, and actually I saw the horrific pictures as well, where, in one of the rooms that Trupti was, one of the rooms in the home, one of the rooms, the girls in those rooms all had, couldn't sleep in the night because they had so much lice in their hair. And for 3 weeks, the only thing she did was bathing every child and, applying the medicine and, getting them rid of the lice. So, and that's nowhere in your role, or that's nowhere in the role of being a psychologist. So, how can you share more stories about what are the other approaches apart from, art-based therapy or counseling that you use with the kids, and what are the small things that you do? Because that is really the uniqueness of your approach.
So, Sachi, I wanted to thank you for asking these great, insightful questions. And perhaps in the time that while Trupti dials back in, you can share. It sounds to me like you've had a lot of personal experience with Trupti, and I've even done work with her occasionally. Perhaps you can share a story or two that gives readers a little more insight into the way Trupti works. I think this story of working with the, getting rid of the lice is such a paints such a vivid picture. And so would love to hear from you if there are other stories like that that you've seen in action.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't, I've heard a lot of stories. Like one is, you know, where in the place where she's going, the women, because they're suffering from such mental illnesses, they are mostly numbed out or, you know, given drugs which will put them to sleep. And so, and they've never met people who care. So I know when she would enter these homes, these women would look at her and but not talk. You know, the way she made her way to them is by using nail cutters, or, you know, when she was cutting the nails of these children, one of the women came and she said that, can you cut my nails as well? And she ended up cutting, and she was worried at that time. You know, the way she shared, she was worried that the woman would spit, or, you know, she would beat her or hit her because she's suffering from such a severe mental illness. But in the end, like, what happened was, like, a really nice relationship that, you know, was transpired from that interaction. And slowly, like, you know, she does things like that where, you know, she will enter and she will basically wish everybody, you know, namaste, or, you know, good morning and things like that. She'll give them high fives and hugs. And it's just amazing. Like, there are kids who will just run to her because, you know, she's so warm.
Yeah. And actually, I have to add to that and say it's not just the kids. I mean, you know, every time I've met her, her warmth has been so just so genuine and generous, and combined with her humility, that it really touches your heart. And maybe that's the heart of, you know, that's at the heart of everything she does. I think we might have Tupti back on the line. Is that true? Tupti?
Yes.
Okay, wonderful. Great. Glad to have you back. Well, we were just sharing stories about you in your absence, but I think Sachi had a follow-up question for you. no worries.
Sachi, I heard the story, the nail cutter story that you were sharing. Could hear, but I couldn't talk. So, yeah.
Yeah, so please add to that, because I know
that. Yes, the question. Yeah. Yes, so just continuing the story that you were sharing. So, in psychology, we use this term called rapport formation as the first step to therapy. And I took the longest to build rapport with the older group of women that I work with. I always felt this gap because even though I studied psychology, no one actually taught me how to cope with my mother's death, or, you know, the fear that I was going through for years together, or coping with the failures that we have. So the theory part and the practical thing, there was a big gap. And so when I entered this home, I didn't find the way that I was taught to do rapport formation. And so I was just looking for a window where I can connect. And literally, because they were under the influence of medicine and they were going through like severe disability, they would just ignore my presence, or, you know, they wouldn't respond to anything. And so my way to connect with these women was a simple nail cutter. And I would just go, and I would the ones who actually responded, I would just go and cut their nails. And we actually did not exchange any words or nothing. And it was just this simple thing which connected us. And like, as time went, they felt that shift was actually that they felt that someone cared for them, and that transformation started happening, because mostly these places, there are like lot of locks, there are a lot of doors, there are a lot of security guards, and the schedule of these homes is mostly they eat, sleep, and there is nothing that's happening inside. There is nothing who cares for them or who asks whether they have eaten, not eaten. So this little thing of, you know, that somebody cares for you I think that started transforming, and now when I go there, I get like lot of smiles and, you know, high fives and a very warm vibe when I leave. So even like, you know, little gestures, like, you know, they offer me food or, you know, it's like, I think now they find a sister in me, or, you know, somebody, they feel that, okay, I am somebody who comes there and, you know, is taking care of something. So, and I realized that the shift or the healing, if I treat myself as a psychologist, I don't think so this would have worked. The healing only happens when there is a deep tie and, you know, when there is friendship. And I'm even considerate of the ethical framework as a psychologist, where we are not supposed to touch the client, or, you know, we are not supposed to hug. But there are times, like, you know, when a child is so much affected and he just comes and, you know, if they just hug me. And of course, at that time, I cannot push them away. So there is this constant conflict that goes in my mind that, you know, what do I do when such things happen? But I don't have answers to it. And, you know, similarly, like with children also, while cultivating few habits and values in them, I had to choose different methods. And children learn more through observation than through instructions. And mostly the system, or they always had complaints that, oh, you know, these children, they don't know anything. And, you know, there was a list of complaints. And so what I started doing was, you know, I myself started doing things. And I started with small practices that I learned from different people, like, you know, Jayesh Bhai, or, you know, from so many friends from MBL and SSP, like, you know, putting shoes in a line, or I started cleaning beds and their cupboards with them, and teaching them how to bathe by actually bathing them, doing a minute of silence before our sessions, and, you know, such little things. And I started seeing the change happening gradually. And it's like the children are so small. They are like 7, 8 years old. And it's the age when they need care. But in these homes, they are actually taking care of themselves and even of their siblings. And so they need a way to be taught in a gentle and creative way. And I know that all of these things, they actually don't fall under the official role or under the hat of a psychologist. But I just feel that these are like some basics which have to be taken care of. So I don't know if this is the approach that I should take, but for now, I feel okay. I feel peaceful, and I think that's my answer. So,
yeah. That's awesome. Yeah, thank you so much. I mean, I was just reminded of a you know, short story where I recently went to one of the biggest social work institute in Mumbai, and I was sharing one of these practices that I do. And the person said, oh, these are great, that's great outcome. Can you please theorize it and tell me what are the tools and techniques you used in this? And I was like, well, you know, I really cannot theorize this. So it reminds me of that, because that's pretty much how, you know, I don't know how you can put these practices in psychology books and, you know, teaching and curriculum. But I also know that the place that you are working in is not an easy place. It's a government home. There is limited staff. There's limited resources. The staff is mostly not sensitive. They're mostly lazy. They, you know, they don't really care about these women or children that are inside the walls. So how do you make your way, you know, not only in terms of getting permission, but even getting their trust? And, you know, what do you do to build a rapport with them? And how do you look at them?
That's true, Sachi. So they actually see these women or the children there as a liability. And I spend few hours with them, and I think they spend the whole day. But I see that there is a disconnection. And they function, I think, more inside the role that they are assigned, and maybe I don't. And there are like so many points, like, you know, the life example that you shared, that wasn't actually my work. And my saturation point came when there were so many lights that at one point the staff actually took phenyl, which we used to like clean toilets, and they actually put that in their heads. And when I came to know, I was angry, but of course I didn't show that because of the authority that they hold. And then I was like, let me take this thing up. Of course, there is always this line where I have to think that, you know, oh, I hope that I'm not interfering in their work. And but somehow, gradually, step by step, I think I keep doing things, even at times, even if I don't have like permission for certain things like this, right? But I start doing, and somehow it's happening. So there is this gap where they say, like recently, a child who is 15 years old, so she is not sure whether the parents that she's living with is her original parents. And the story that she told me is like, at the age of 4, I think, you know, I was staying in Calcutta and then I was brought here. And then I was pushed to do sex work. And then she went to the police station and she complained. And now her so-called mother, she's in the prison. And now she's thinking of taking the case back. And so there's like so much of confusion that I saw in her mind, which was going on, that, you know, who are her real parents? And, you know, what will she do once she's out? And, you know, she doesn't want to be an orphan also. And at the same time, and that is the reason why she wants to go back. So, you know, all this confusion is going at one point. And on the other hand, she's throwing anger tantrums to the ones who are to the like superintendent and the ayahs who help there, the kitchen staff. And when I went inside the office, they said that, oh, this girl is behaving in such a way, and, you know, she's such a headache, and, you know, they started complaining. But they are not what the child is going through. And that is where I had to intervene and say that, okay, you know, this is the history. This is where she's coming from, and this is the dilemma that she's going through. And, you know, if we can do something about this, maybe something will change in her behavior. So I see that the sensitivity or the angle that I bring in, that is lacking. But I think that's my role to do. Like, you know, they do all the paperwork, which I don't do. Maybe this is something that I bring, which they don't. So I think that's my job. And, you know, with these little things, when they see actually me doing roles that I'm not supposed to, which I don't even, it's not, but I'm like proving a point, but I just feel that, okay, it's okay to do these things also. So at times, you know, I'm even sweeping the floor or, you know, doing such things also, and which I find that it's okay. So that is how at least I try to bridge the system also, the children also, the population that I'm working also, and bring different flavors that I learn from anywhere and from any person. So I don't restrict my work to like a certain role or, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think it's not only the children who are seeing you, it's also the staff who's seeing you, and that's why you know, this is a place where most people will not be allowed, but you're given such free entry. So that's awesome. Rish?
Yeah. Thank you, Sachi and Trupti. Before you continue, I just wanted to remind listeners very quickly that you can queue up for questions at this point if you have a question for Trupti by pressing *6, and that'll place you in the queue for questions. And we'll get to Q&A in another 5 minutes or so. Please go ahead, Sachi.
Yeah. Well, I have a whole list of questions, but I think I'm trusting the Q&A team to take care of that. But my last question to you is, you know, this is really hard work, and I know you don't think it is hard work, but you are meeting emotions which are so traumatic and difficult, and you're constantly coming across people who are so broken in some ways. And so how does that affect you, and how do you keep yourself healthy in places like that and, you know, keep yourself sane?
Yes, so when I started doing this, my sisters were highly concerned, and, you know, they told me that, oh, you know, this is like, you know, you should take care of yourself. And there was like a whole list of things. Even I remember having conversations with you and how there is like a high percentage of burnout. But and like I always say that somehow if, you know, I have to design a website, or maybe if I have to deal with numbers or accounts, I think that is more difficult for me than this. So actually, I don't find this work as difficult. It's like a regular thing for me. But of course, the emotion, especially when I'm working with children and when I see them in a vulnerable state, that affects me the most. But there I, the practices, the small practices, that is something which helps me ground myself. Of course, the community that I'm surrounded with, there is so much of strength that I draw from there. People like Arun Dada, or, you know, awakened circles that we have, or, you know, Vipassana, prayer circles. Actually, prayers, that helps me a lot. So these are little things which helps me reflect, align back to my values. And I think those are my energizers, which keeps me going.
Yeah, thank you. Rish, do we take questions?
Good. If you have one more question, Sachi, yeah. And then we'll go to Q&A.
Okay, awesome. So that's great. Thank you. I wanted to ask you that, one is, you lost your mother at a really young age. I believe you were 9 then. And at the same time, I also know that you have a close relationship with Arun Dada, and, you know, you served Meerabai when she was dying. And, you know, how was that for you? Like, one is your mother's loss and the impact of that, and then, you know, your understanding of death, because I know it's changed over time. And so how, you know, what's that like?
Yes, so I wasn't actually 9. I was in my second year, so I think around 19. I've seen my mother's death, of course, very closely, and there have been like many deaths in our family. Because you even brought Meerabai, I would say that her death actually changed my definitions of death, the way I saw death. And I always associated death with a lot of pain and like intense emotions. And I had made a very strong image of death. When I saw Meerabai's death, it gave me a whole new perspective to it. I heard Arun Dada and Meerabai share the kind of environment that was there when Vinoba ji passed away, and they shared that it was like a celebration. I couldn't relate to it much, but actually when I saw Meerabai's death, I now know what they were talking about, and her death was more like a celebration of the way she lived her life. For sure, after her passing away, there is a huge void of her wisdom, of having first-hand information of her experiences, or, you know, her perspective. The way one should live life, actually that reflected, that was reflected during her death. And so it's quite unbelievable, but you know, Ba's dead body was lying inside and serving people with his songs. And there was like continuous chants of Shubh Mangal Ho, and during her funeral time, you know, there was like so much of lightness. The whole environment was so peaceful. And that's when I realized that why did I take so much time to come out of my mother's death? or you know, what was the trauma or such intense emotions. And I realized that it wasn't because I loved her so much, but it was because out of the dependency that I had on her. And my dependency showed my inefficiency. And the clinging was more to my to the comfort that I had because of her. And the pain was because of the discomfort after, you know, she died. So that was a strong realization which happened during Ba's death. And in the last days when I observed Ba and Dada. And I think Ba's death shifted something strong in me. And it's now, it's not like, of course, I miss her. But now the missing is not the clinging side, but it's more like in a happy way. So I don't know if I'm able to put like my experience, what I felt during Mirabai's death, but the definitions of death or the way our life should be lived, I think that shifted to a great extent after seeing Mirabai's death.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you very much, Tupti, and Sachi as well for that beautiful conversation. I must say that I am absolutely grateful, Tupti, to hear from you in this forum, because in all the time that we've spent together, I think this is the first that I'm hearing so extensively about the type and the extent of the work you do and also the motivation behind it. Which probably means that I don't know how to ask the right questions as well as Sachi does. So I'll try to be more probing about that. I'm going to read you a couple of comments that have come through on the web, just so you know what people are thinking. This is from David Dawn. He says, love and compassion. This is in response to, I think, your written reflections. He says, love and compassion are very important in healing and often not enough. Wise and skillful intervention is often also needed. Anesthetic is very important and typically not enough. Anesthetic may eliminate or cover the pain, and it takes surgery to eliminate the problem or source of the pain. The right combination of compassion and skill, anesthetic and surgery, work together very well. And I think just throughout this conversation, one of the things that you've shown is how you've come to a place of balance between that skillful intervention as well as, you know, anesthetic and surgery, if you will. So thank you again for sharing that. I did have one question for you, Tupti. I've had the privilege of meeting your father and at least one of your sisters that I can remember. It was very clear to me that your family is very unique in terms of not just what they hold dear, but what they encourage, you know, and how they encourage you to follow what you want to do. Certainly what you said earlier in the conversation about the values that a family holds dear are what you can hold on to during a time of crisis, and that's kind of, and that that becomes your North Star, rings true from what I've seen of your family. Could you share ways in which your parents, you know, your mother while she was there, your father and your sisters have influenced you and shaped this journey of yours?
Rish, can you just repeat the last two lines? I wasn't able to hear.
Yeah, absolutely. I was wondering if you could share the ways in which your parents and your family, your sisters, your father have influenced you and shaped your journey.
Yes, so I'm the youngest in the family, and I think that's a privilege. And I keep telling people that, you know, the hard work is actually done by my sisters and my family. And I'm just walking down the path and, you know, just eating the fruits, which, you know, the trees were planted by them, and I'm just cherishing the fruits. And that's true, because I was like eating everything that's happening around me, the people that I'm associated with, or, you know, all the experiments that are happening here, it's because of them. And I was just sharing with my sister today evening that I don't have to actually go out all that I need is inside, under like one roof. And it's such a privilege, especially when I go to such places where I work in, where people don't have families, or they don't have siblings, or, you know, when I see, especially when I was working with girls who were rescued from trafficking, I was just thinking of the blessings that I'm blessed with, just to have a family or parents or siblings. Each time I would go, I would step into, you know, those spaces or listen to their stories. Gratitude kept on like flowing. And of each member of my family, of course, they bring a very different kind of quality. And I think through, like, children learn through observation. I think I have learned observing them. And literally, I think all the little things I'm doing right now, I think it's because of them. Seriously, it's not just for the sake of saying, but that's actually true. Each and everything that I do, it's all introduced by them. So all that you hear, it's because of them.
Okay, and I think people actually know how amazing your family is, because I have now a comment from Rahul, and he is complaining that how can one family have so many stars, the wisdom of Jignasa, the effervescence of Swara, who are your two sisters, and the beginner's mind of Trilok uncle. I think you answered this question, but again, what's it like to be in this talented, loving, ever-seeking Pandya household as its youngest brat? So another question that has come up around your I guess, many experiments is, and this is actually from two people here, there are stories circulating about you having shaved your head one fine day to donate for wigs for cancer patients. Mm-hmm. Could we learn more about that? What inspired you to do that?
Yes. So as a child, I think I was super obsessed with my hair. And I remember that you know, before going to sleep, I used to actually comb my hair and place the comb under my pillow. And as soon as I used to wake up, the very first thing that I used to do was comb my hair again. And of course, that sounds super crazy. But later, when my mother was diagnosed with cancer, I had heard that, you know, people lose their hair because of the therapies that they go through. And my mom had like long, pretty hair. So instead of praying for her to get well, I started praying to God to keep her hair as it is. Just because I was very scared to see her without hair. And thankfully, she retained her hair, till she died. But I didn't realize that, you know, subconsciously, there was like so much of attachment that was happening, that was growing like stronger and stronger. And later, I remember when I went for my, I think, for a 10-day sit, there was a Dhamma server who was serving, and I saw her without hair, and I was shocked again, and I was like, oh, how can like somebody do this? So as time went, I realized that, oh my God, you know, there is like so much attachment that I'm having around hair, and this isn't a great thing to do. So you know, of course, there is like so much of attachment, association of beauty with hair. So I think that I thought that this was too much. So my birthday was coming closer. And so I decided that, okay, I need to, you know, break this attachment. And so I went and, you know, I just told that, you know, please like shave off my head. So, and when that was happening, I initially closed my eyes. And, you know, I did not look when the hair was falling down. And then I was like, no, you know, I should actually see. And when I saw, I could see all the baggage, all the attachment, all the social and emotional associations that I had with
wow.
it. It started falling
wow.
off.
Wow.
And I think that, I and after that, now it's I feel so much lighter. And on a lighter note, I used to tell people that, you know, I'm cutting cost on the oil, shampoo, water, and, like, you know, so much time that I spend behind it. So, you know, that's how I've done that. So, and I think that this incident taught me a lot to actually give away things that I was holding, especially even at like materialistic level. So, yeah, that's the story.
That's amazing. That's you know, I think it goes back to Sachi's point that she was making earlier, which is your ability to go at the heart of things. Even the comment you made about, I realized I wasn't suffering from asthma, I was suffering from fear. I feel like similar insights in here and amazing experimentations. So thank you for sharing that. We also have a question from Kozo, who I'm going to unmute. Kozo, go ahead. Please ask your question.
Hi, Sachi, Rish, and Tripti. Thank you for this beautiful conversation. Tripti, I have a question for you. There's a well-known story in Hawaii about a therapist. His name is Hugh Len, and he went into a asylum for the criminally insane, and he didn't see a patient. He just went into his office and opened the files of these patients and said basically a prayer. He said, please forgive me, I'm sorry, I love you, thank you, over and over and over. And then he'd go to the next file, please forgive me, I'm sorry, I love you, thank you, over and over and over. And the patients got better. And within 8 years, they shut down the ward for the criminally insane because they didn't have any more patients coming through. And I sense a very similar energy that you're doing in this home for women and children. And I'm wondering if you could share any stories about maybe not so much acts of kindness, but just thoughts and prayers and well wishes, or just your demeanor when you walk around the hospital, how that affects the patients and the staff.
Right. Thank you Kozo, for, you know, sharing that story and for this question, because there are times, especially I was reminded of this one incident when I was cutting nails, and I was interacting with this one woman, and she was talking, so she's diagnosed with schizophrenia. And she was talking to God, and then I we had like few we were talking about on God, and then I said that, oh, do you know any prayers? And she said, no, I don't, but, you know, if you do, can you sing a prayer for me? And I actually started singing, and we do such little things, right, which actually doesn't fall into the psychological thing. But like simple experiments, like while we were planting plants, we actually prayed for that plant. Or, you know, when we were having a walk outside with the children, we went and hugged the tree. So I actually believe in all these things where maybe at like actual physical or mental level, the actions are not doing much, but at a metaphysical level, there is a lot that is happening and that is shifting, and maybe change. Something is getting changed within the higher consciousness. So, yeah, these are, I think, few experiments that we do.
Thank you. Thank you for all you're doing, Tripti. It's beautiful.
Thank you,
Tripti.
Yeah. Tripti, because we have time, I also want to ask you a question about your family. And, you know, you guys basically shifted from Africa to India when you were 7 years old. And I know that was a tough transition for you. So So can you share a little bit about that?
Yes, Sachi. So my birthplace is actually Africa, and for 6 years I stayed there, and after that the whole family shifted to India. And I was only 6 years old, but I had a very strong resistance. I don't know why. And I remember my mother was packing the bags and everything, and she had to lock me up in the storeroom because I was just not letting her pack the bags. And for a year, I think till I turned 18 or 20, every year I would remind my dad that, you know, it wasn't a great decision to shift to India. I think the reasons behind it was like, of course, we had to like adjust, socially, culturally. But one thing that strongly affected me was the monetary part, the financial part. My father's business didn't go very well here, and later he actually had to shut his factory, and since then I think this feeling of scarcity was always there. Today when I think as a child, I remember I had even started stealing. And I still remember once I was just walking down, and you know, I saw a packet of cheese slice in my neighbor's dustbin, which I had eaten. And today when I actually think about it, I actually don't know whether, you know, actually there was scarcity or maybe that was just in the air. This scarcity part actually took a very long time for me to see the abundance side. And I think the walking pilgrimage that I did, I think that shifted the whole thing. But and even Awakened Circles, I remember, you know, when Jiggy started it, for like almost 2 years, every Wednesday I used to walk out of the house. And the reason that I gave was, you know, how can we open up a space for others, for strangers, when we ourselves don't have enough. And I couldn't actually get, you know, why are we like, I used to ask questions like, you know, who will pay for the food that, you know, we are offering, or, you know, the electricity bills, you know, I used to make all these comments. And it was later when I experienced so much of kindness, so much of generosity, things shifted. But those years, I think I suffered this scarcity thing a lot. So that's the story of, and now, of course, now I don't cry. And of course, I'll go to Africa someday. But now I'm peaceful with the transition.
You know, this only amplifies Rahul Bhai's comment about you being the youngest brat. So, but thank you for sharing. This is really personal, and yeah, it's great insights. I was also thinking that, you know, Arun Dada has been a great influence. Arun Dada is a Gandhian grandfather living in Baroda, and he's been a great influence on you and your family. And so is there any particular story that comes to your mind, you know, which has particularly influenced you? If you can share that.
Yes. Yeah, there are like so many stories, but you know, one story which is coming up for me actually two stories are coming up. I see if I have time to share both. But Arun Dada, once he was sharing about you know, his trip to there were like communal tension going between the Greeks and the Turks, and he was sent there as Shanti Sainik. You know, peace soldier. And one day he was out for his morning walk, and on his way he saw there were like few tents, and two to three boys, when they saw Dada coming, they actually ran to their tents, and you know, they came up with a gun, actually the air gun. And as Dada came closer to him, they pointed at him And Dada did not know if these boys were Greeks or were Turks. He did not speak the same language. And so, you know, four of them, they were just standing there. And Dada, as he came closer, he patted on one boy's shoulder. He smiled and he made an eye contact and he said hello. And like after those few moments of, you know, conversation, Dada started walking uphill. He went up, watched the sunrise, offered his morning prayers and started walking down. And while he was walking down, the same boys, they ran again inside the tents, and this time they offered him like two fistful of almonds. And when Dada was sharing this, I actually had goosebumps. And you know, Dada then shared that I don't know what got transferred in those moments. But what I remember even today are the smiles and laughter that we exchanged. And with this story, I was just thinking about what is his inner cultivation, right? Which shifted the guns, and you know, there were like almonds which were offered. And there have been like so many instances when this is reflected, where you know, the whole thing, it changes. And with this story, at least my takeaway is, you know, how can I cultivate practices, or maybe I still don't know what do I practice to transform people like this. So that's one story. And, you know, another story which I can quickly share is, you know, now he shared about his experience of Satyagraha, which lasted for like 14 years. And like every 15 days, he used to travel from Bhavnagar to Bombay. And the protest was against the biggest slaughterhouse, which is in Bombay. And the capacity of this slaughterhouse is to actually slaughter 10,000 cattle at a time. So, so this is one part of the story. And the other part of the story is he met one butcher. Who like almost 80% of the time he used like lot of abusive language. So Dada was like, you know, oh, you know, come and sit with me and, you know, let's have a conversation. So he was like, okay, Dada. And, you know, so with time he established a friendship with him and started having reflective conversations. And then Dada said that, you know, do you think that you like use lot of abusive language? So he said like, yes, Dada, I know about it. So then Dada gave him a task of, you know, he said that, okay, all the number of times you remember God, you know, because you go to the mosque, so I'm sure that you believe in him. And so all the number of times you remember God, tally that. And, you know, the number of times you use abusive language, just, you know, keep the count. So he said, okay. And then, you know, at the end of that day, Dada came and he was like, okay, you know, give me the number. So the butcher, his name was Mahmood. So Mahmood said that, Dada, this is a tough job. And, you know, it was only like for a few hours that I could keep the count. And, you know, then I dropped the plan. So Dada was like, okay, no problem. You know, you can continue with this tomorrow also. So this went on and on and on. And, you know, one day he came and he was like, Dada, you know, I think, you know, my language is changing. So with this, my learning was that, you know, even so, like for 14 years, it's like a big time, right? Every 15 days to travel from like almost 500, 600 kilometers to stop the slaughter thing that was happening there. And the non-violent protest was only against the system and not against any individual person. Like the butcher was involved in the activity, but Dada said very clearly that, you know, I did not have anything against the person, and it was only against the system. And when I heard this, I was a non-vegetarian till now, and of course there was this thought of quitting non-vegetarian food. And when I saw this person in front of me, who has worked like so hard, dedicatedly, like for 14 years, I decided in my mind that, okay, I'm leaving non-vegetarian food. But after 2 days, I was like, I hope I'm not emotional and, you know, I'm taking this decision. So I took 2 days to think over. And then I went to Dada and I said, okay, Dada, I want to confess. I don't know if I'm telling it to myself or to you, but from today, I'm going to be a vegetarian. And, you know, so that is his power. He had no intentions of changing me. He even didn't know that I'm a non-vegetarian. But that's the power of his cultivation, his years of cultivation. And that is how he has influenced my life.
Thank you, Trupti. We have time for one more question. And so what I'd like to do, Trupti, is ask you, it's kind of a combination of things that other people have asked, as well as something we like to ask each of our callers. You are on what looks like an amazing trajectory of both personal practice as well as service. And so one of the questions for you is there any way, or what way can this community, the service-based community, support the work that you do?
I think, Krish, it's already doing, like, all the little things that you heard that I'm doing, that I'm personally practicing, or maybe that I'm doing at my workplace. It's the combination of things that I learn from the feeds, maybe that people are posting on service-based, or when I meet people in person, it's already serving me in so many ways. So there is like nothing special that I would love, but just like, you know, it's like such a humbling experience to that you ask this, but actually I think that all that I have is enough. So nothing more to ask.
Okay, great. Thank you. And once again, I think a very enlightening conversation for all of us. Sachi, thank you for your insightful questions. You know, we covered your personal journey, Trupti, your the motivation for your work. We have some great reflections here from people who joined via the web. One of them just encapsulating, I think, this conversation, saying mercy and love from which all arises. So indeed, thank you for your love and for sharing that love, Trupti, with this community. What we'll do now is hold a collective minute of silence in gratitude. And after that silence, we'll open up the lines and do a gratitude out loud together to Trupti. But first, let's do a minute of gratitude. Okay, thank you. I'm going to switch mute to off now, and all callers will be able to jump. And on the count of three, let's all say thank you. One, two, three. Thank you, Trupti.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.